Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So the autumn colors are coming to an end, but still some glorious maple trees out there. We've got the sun to radiate them, which is very nice. When we look at something like the changing colors of autumn, implicit in our looking is a certain understanding of nature. We understand that autumn is a condition in nature, so it's a part of a cycle of our seasons, and the colors of the leaves are caused by the change in light and chlorophyll and other such things. And so when we see the red color, we see the beauty of it, or the yellow color, we see the beauty of it, but also there's a certain understanding, isn't there? There's an understanding that this is the way nature changes according to the seasons, and that this change is predictable to some extent, not totally what color it will be and so on, but it's predictable because it's part of a causal relationship. It's natural. And those two aspects of nature, causality and change, are paramount in the Buddhist teaching in understanding our own minds, because our minds are a part of nature. Our happiness and unhappiness is a part of nature, and the perspectives which we're trying to encourage in the self looking that we're doing, in the self awareness that we're practicing, is this sort of understanding which is implicit in the way we look at the maple tree. We understand that. We might, none of us verbalize that as we were looking at the trees. Mostly we just were very happy to see the beautiful colors. So that kind of implicit understanding, that way of seeing things which has wisdom in it, is what we call right understanding. And that's not just a intellectual structure that you believe in, is it? I don't believe in causality and change. I just know that's just a part of nature. I don't disbelieve it either. I just know. And that's the wisdom factor functioning. And so the same about our own, the way we deal with life, and also the inner happenings of our mind, our emotions, and our memories, and all of that, they function under the same principles. But sometimes that kind of implicit understanding about our emotions or the memories we have, or the personal histories that we've experienced, and so on and so forth, sometimes we forget that kind of way of seeing, that way of understanding, and we get caught up in wrong ways of understanding. We take things personally, we react in ways which are not based upon wisdom. So to bring that, to make that conscious all the time, is that this moment, both in its the way it presents itself to me and the way I interpret it, is changing, and it's causally conditioned. To bring that to our emotional life, to bring that to our interrelationship with people, to bring that to all the movements of consciousness that we experience, is what we call right seeing or right understanding, and is something that needs to be continually reflected upon and remembered. One of the understandings, or one of the principles of nature which is rather difficult to understand, is around the word dukkha. The word dukkha is used in various ways in the texts. One is just a simple dukkha vedana. So you have the dukkha vedana is the unpleasant affective tone or feeling of an experience, or and sukha is its opposite. Sukha vedana is the pleasant or attractive tone, affect of an experience. So you have pain in my hip has dukkha vedana, and then I move my hip and I walk around and there's sukha vedana. I feel anguish about someone who is sick and I'm worried about them, that's dukkha vedana. And then they come right and they come to some kind of healthy balance, they're smiling again, I feel sukha vedana. So dukkha and sukha are at that kind of fundamental level of our experiences is one way that dukkha is used. Another way that it's used in the Four Noble Truths, of the whole idea of suffering, that we as human beings experience conflict and stress and modes of unhappiness and suffering which are caused by misunderstanding, caused by attachment to desire. So you have dukkha as it's used in the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, it's such a broad word, suffering sometimes is too limited, so it's good to use the word dukkha. And the third way that the word dukkha is used in our teaching is the nature of all sense experience is that it has kind of inherent characteristics in it. It has change, it has impersonality, and it has dukkha. And this is the third way this is used. And this is just this is not a kind of Buddhist judgment about experience. It's simply just saying that experience is just that way. So you have to understand dukkha, how that's used in that context. And it's used as the word quite often is unsatisfactory, and it's used in relationship to the fulfillment of the heart, the enlightenment of the heart, nibbana, or the deathless or the unconditioned, and so it's pointing to the fact that anything which is causally related, which is caused by other factors, has a certain instability in it. It has a certain amount of uncertainty in it. So Ajahn Chah would use all the time about our sense experience, maine, it's uncertain. He tended to, at least from what I remember, I heard that more than change. And so it's the same idea. This is uncertain. So I'd go to him about a perception. I have someone in the monastery trying to get his take on the person. He wouldn't bite. He'd say, it's uncertain. Thanks a lot. But it was true. You know, my perception had been built around certain factors. It's uncertain perceptions and so on. And it's uncertain, and it's not personal in the sense that the perceptions I have and the feelings I have are just the causal way the mind works. I don't really own a perception. It just comes because of causes and conditions. I perceive my mother in a certain way because I'm her son, and Ajahn Kusala perceives her in a certain way because he is a friend and knows her from a different way. But our perceptions couldn't possibly be the same. They're not right and wrong. They're just caused by a certain number of factors. So they're within me, but I don't really own them. They're caused by other conditions. And then dukkha, this idea of unsatisfactoriness, is the real nub of the characteristic of sense experience, is that because these things are caused by other factors, they're not independent of other factors, because there are inputs that come that are not in our control and that will create things which are not in our control, it means that you can't really rely on it, and so it has this characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. In terms of if I'm seeking spiritual enlightenment or liberation of the heart in that which is uncertain, then it will always be disappoint me. So it's unsatisfactory. So, and this is the kind of paradox you get in Buddhist teaching, is that these beautiful trees are unsatisfactory. You know, so it sounds pretty heavy. And you know, does that mean I can never look at the trees? It sounds pretty crazy, actually. But here, dukkha is used different than dukkha vedana. So dukkha vedana is the sense of unpleasant feeling, but unsatisfactoriness is saying, well, it's beautiful now. You can appreciate it. You can be grateful for it, but don't rely on it. Don't rely on it for fulfillment. So that when it's a gray day and it rains for 4 days and there's no more brightness in the sky, well, how else could it be? That's just in the nature of things. For a tree, that's quite easy to remember. But to actually bring forth that's kind of characteristics of reflection into all of our life, that's a bit more difficult. If we feel very inspired by a monastery or a teacher or something, and for a teacher to say, well, that's inspiration is unsatisfactory. What's the teacher pointing to? It's not saying that inspiration is depression. It's not. Not saying that inspiration is wrong. It's helpful. But don't rely on life always being inspiring. Obviously, it can't be, because it's causally related. You need certain kinds of causes for you to feel inspired. And you cannot sustain those causes all the time. It's impossible. It's impossible to always be inspired. But you can be aware. And when you see that awareness is something larger than inspiration and disappointment, it's a background which knows, then you begin to understand what this teaching around unsatisfactoriness is pointing to. It's not negating beauty. It's not saying that's wrong, but just saying, don't rely on it. There's something deeper. There's something more profound than just sense happiness or sense beauty. So we can use beauty. We can go for a walk in the woods and uplift our hearts with the sun and the light. That can be very, very helpful. But it's not a refuge. It's not liberation, because it's still causally related. It's still dependent on other things. So all experience, whether it's like a profound meditative experience or just a mundane experience of a nice apple, the beauty is as it is, but that's not the place to seek yourself. So where do we find refuge? We find refuge in beginning to perceive life in this dharmic way. Like when you have some kind of negative emotion that comes up, if you perceive it as something that is causally conditioned, so when with this as condition, that arises. When there is insult as condition, there is hurt feeling as condition. With this, there is that causal relationship. If you look at it like that, and that this will change, this feeling will change. These conditions will change. If I can look at, say, like negative emotions in that particular way, then there's a certain aloofness, in a good way. Aloofness, I actually like the word aloof. Our culture sort of heightens intimacy. That seems to be terribly important, but I think there's something about aloofness which has a kind of, for me, it has a sense of freedom in it, but aloofness from this grasping of the emotional world, of the sense world. So some negative emotion comes up, and there's the capacity to say, with this, there's that. With this kind of input, there's this kind of mindset coming up, and it will change. Now, if I can see life in this way, to interpret life in this way, it gives me a kind of cool distance with the things that come and they go. I'm no longer just driven by the passions of the heart, be they negative or positive. And yesterday I went to the new Museum of Nature on Metcalf in Ottawa. Fabulous building, just fabulous. And I don't know if you know the structure, but it's a Victorian structure. It used to have on the front at the Metcalf entrance, it used to have a 7-story tower. And in 1916, I forget when they built it. They built it at turn of the century, I think. Unfortunately, they built it on clay. So apparently the talk in Ottawa for the last 43 years is this thing is sinking, and they finally sussed it now. They've done a very good job. But what happened is that the front tower was sinking into the clay and was pulling the whole building forward. So in 1916, they dismantled the front tower. And now they've done a two-year renovation, and those of you who are from Ottawa, which is most of us here, I guess, or know Ottawa, you realize there's a beautiful glass, they call it the Queen's Lantern. So it's a six or eight-story tall glass box on the front of this building. It's absolutely fabulous. I don't know how it stands up there. Very beautifully done. So anyway, I was there yesterday. What's this got to do with Dharma? I was there yesterday, and what I noticed arising was what we would have called that architectural greed. Because Ajahn Kusala and I have been talking about Dharma halls and meditation halls, and I've been looking at a whole set of architectural books that someone got for me from U of O and University of Carleton. That's just so fabulous. I like this incredible building around, it might be a synagogue from Frank Lloyd Wright from, I think it's Philadelphia, just a fabulous building. And the materials Frank Lloyd Wright used, right? So then I see all this glass and this beautiful use of stainless steel. And of course what arises is, I want that. I want that for my building. And it wasn't so gross, but I could just see with this as condition that arises. You know, with thinking, with thinking about buildings, and Ajahn Kusala have been involved in some very beautiful buildings, so get a sense of the kind of materials that one might use. So with that stimulation of mind, and then this contact with this fabulous piece of architecture and renovation, what arises in the mind, I want that. And you know, we were thinking of doing a concrete scree floor like in Birkin with underfloor heating, which looks great. But then I saw the slate tiles. Ooh, I like that. And that's and I could say to myself, oh, I shouldn't think that way, I'm a monk. And that's taking it personally. But how else would I think if I'd just been thinking about that? You know, I wouldn't think, we don't need, well, maybe I could, we don't need anything, we can. So I did the opposite. I said, well, okay, we'll live, you know, we'll build it with OSB board and cinder block and put linoleum floors on. I just the most awful thing you could think of. So it's not to say that you can, you know, like you could do either one, do some kind of super ascetic trip or whatever, but just to notice what the mind does. You know, with this as condition that arises. And then it's okay. And one still lives in the world and one tries to make things of beauty and so on. But to be driven by the obsession for beauty, or to be driven by the obsession for frugality, both what you could see would be not a very happy way to live, right? Just kind of driven by any kind of a position. But to see how positions arise, so maybe I see the slate floor, and I think we really need that. Because, you know, this is a significant temple, and, you know, I could rationalize my greed and so on, and then argue with Ajahn Kusala, and hopefully he'd smile at me. But it's just to see that this is just the way the mind works. It works that way. But the thing about dukkha is that this particular movement of mind is not liberation. Getting a slate floor for this meditation hall is really not liberation. It's simply worldly dharmas. That's the way worldly dharmas are. My mom just got a new fridge. Right? New fridge. My brother got it. And the shipment has an error in the shelving. So the shelves, it should be a certain way, they're not a certain way, and there isn't this meat compartment. There's all these, you know, options that we have. It's interesting to see, you know, poor old mum, she sees the fridge now, and rather than being happy, she thinks, we got ripped off with the shelves. And it's a perfect, you know, it's a really good fridge. It's a really good fridge. But the perception is, we got done by the manager. My brother is negotiating. He's not like me. But you see how well, this has conditioned, like if mom didn't know that there's a difference in the shelving, she'd be happy with seeing it. But now there's this other idea, well, there should have been other shelving, and there's a negative. So this has conditioned that arises, right? And it's just like autumn leaves. Just, not so pretty sometimes, but it's just the same kind of movement in consciousness with something that you expected and it comes through, you feel satisfied. Something you expected, you got disappointed, you feel dissatisfied. And so the mind is, the thinking mind, the emotional mind going through those movements. And that movement, in all of that movement, it's not, you can't trust it. You just can't trust it. Because it's not stable. So what is stable? What is stability? Well, the way we look at it is stability is the capacity to see change, to see causal arising, dependent origination. That's where you can really find a place of stability, which isn't the same as like having a kind of experience. It's a way of knowing experience. And so this is what we are asked to do, to train in a way of seeing and understanding and perceiving life, which liberates the heart. But they're not to deny the other, that if to work hard to create a space for other beings to practice as well as ourselves is a wonderful offering of dana. To go through all the hassles that involves, that it's a wonderful offering of dana. And to think about beauty is fine. To use beauty as a way of uplifting the mind. That's all, it's not sort of a hair shirt philosophy kind of thing. But just to see that the liberation really of the heart has to be in here, can't be out there. So that the forces of disappointment and fulfillment of expectations, that's part of your practice. You don't take refuge in that. One of the I've been teaching at the university, and people who don't really have much idea of Buddhism or meditation and so on, and just kind of getting across ideas that, like, you can know a mood of the mind. A simple idea like that you can, as a, you can witness a mood. So I'm in the museum, and I can witness a mood. I felt really like I loved the kind of high atrium ceiling, So it's a very uplifted mood, right? Which is causally conditioned, and I can enjoy that. But then maybe going and being somewhere else and being in a different situation, it's a depressed mood. And we can witness to that. We're quite. There's something amazing about human consciousness, is that we can witness this movement, and to witness to a mood of the mind, and to not make it a problem. To enjoy the beauty, but not to think that beauty is permanent. To see that beauty is unsatisfactory, and that's a really hard idea to get across, because it does sound like we're saying that you shouldn't. There should be no beauty, or beauty is dangerous. Well, it's only dangerous if you attach to it. But so is ugliness if you attach to that. But to see beauty for just as it is, so there's something beautiful that affects you in an uplifting way. Ah, yeah, that's beauty. And to abide in that, and even to use that if you want. But then the other, to see something which is gross or negative or something negative in some way, to say, oh, that the mind gets conditioned that way. And the more we can abide as that witnessing, knowing mind, which knows change, which knows dependent origination, the more we intuit where the peace of the heart lies. So you can see how, like, implicitly I see the maple tree, and in my mind there is the understanding of nature. So when there are no more leaves, I don't feel disappointed. I just, oh, they're gone. They're just gone, aren't they? It's not a problem. If it was a problem, I'd have a problem. So we understand that, don't we? It's not so, and it's the same. But the same thing now with our own hearts, and that's more difficult, because we tend to take it personally. We tend to judge or get caught up in all kinds of wrong identities with these things. And so the Buddha's practice of right understanding or right view is not just leaving it as a kind of dead religious artifact in your library shelf, anicca, dukkha, anatta, change, unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, impersonality, not just leaving it as a kind of dead idea that you put on the shrine, but something that is constantly enlivening my looking, my seeing, my understanding. So that has to be remembered. So this kind of teaching for too many times, I don't know, but to actually enliven the mind that, this is conditioned. So just to take that as like an exercise in a month or in a lifetime to say, this, that whole teaching around this, that conditionality, with this, there's that. With this kind of input, there's this kind of feeling. Without this, there's not this. When this ends, this other ends. So someone compliments you and you feel reassured. Feels this way, with this or that. And someone disparages your work, you feel annoyed or let down. With this, there is that. We can engage socially with, you know, with our various responsibilities, but that inner work is getting beyond this duality of praise and blame, of beauty and ugliness, of good times and bad times, you know, that kind of that worldly stuff that keeps grabbing our attention. And so our practice is this kind of steady seeing the way things are according to Dhamma rather than according to our own views and opinions. Some habits are very insidious. Like talking to this group on Thursday night at the library, I started to talk about the nature of self-disparagement, the nature of attachment to idealism, the nature of our self-criticism, self-judgments that can be very strong in an intellectual mind which has high ideals, which a lot of us have, that how deeply embedded those structures and how hard they are to see them. And several people came up to me and said, could you talk more about that? And those kinds of things that seem so believable, like something like self-criticism or fearful states of mind or sense of being put upon or what, you know, there's really, really deep kind of things. They seem so real. They don't seem like conditions. That seems like the ultimate truth. That it takes a lot of training to remember that that's not who you are. That's not ultimate truth. It's just a mood. It's just a thought. It's just something that is causally conditioned. The problem is, of course, some of the conditionality comes from way back. You know, it comes from when I was 4, 5, 6, 7 years old or before, and it's become so ingrained in self-view, in self-perception, that it seems like it's an ultimate truth. And then whenever it's triggered, the mind projects outwards, this is the truth. And so the challenge is to make this perception of change, dependent origination, universal to all conditions, all states of mind. And that means a constant kind of remembering. With this, there is that. With this as condition, that arises. When this isn't, that isn't. That kind of viewing of things. And you do get the hang of it. So in the beginning, like you get it around things which aren't too threatening. Just maybe something very, very mundane. But the deeper things still tend to overwhelm. You know, one finds oneself just caught up in a mood and believing it very strongly and projecting it outwards onto other people and all that, and then all of a sudden, whoa, where am I going with that? Boy, I really got lost in that. And then the mind awakens again, or maybe it just kind of wears out from, you know, just having a fight with someone or whatever it is, and then you come back to sanity, really, don't you? You kind of return to sanity. And then it's just kind of, it's just like reinforcing this way of seeing things, way of viewing things. with this, there is that. This is uncertain. And so Ajahn Chah would always just keep emphasizing, maine, it's uncertain. And if I could bring that constantly into my view of life, that my inner view of life, this is uncertain. Now, that sounds like it might be quite depressing. You know, you're always, this is uncertain, this is uncertain. But what happens when I notice life as it changes, rather than being caught up in a change? What does that feel like? It was actually feel like not to be caught up. Well, the idea was that it brings you to peace and silence, that perspective, not that it negates beauty. You know, it brings you to peace and silence because you're perceiving or looking at life through the lens of the Dhamma. When you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. You see like the Buddha sees. That's the idea of it. When in one's own practice, we try to diagnose those areas of consciousness where self-view is very, very strong, where the sense of self and other is very, very strong. It might be through blame, it might be through infatuation, it might be through disappointment, it might be through aversion, all kinds of ways. But for me, always, I know if I've got a really strong sense of self and other, that's the warning signs. Be careful. This is Mara. Don't believe it. There's a whole different state of mind when I feel critical about something because I think it's being done in an inappropriate way, and it's just simply, no, that's inappropriate. There isn't the power of self and other. Then it's actually quite okay. One can feel critical. But when, say, the critical mind has a strong sense of right and wrong, that's delusion. You know, that strong sense of me and other. Even if you're right, even if I'm right in something, in some kind of conventional social sense, that strong sense of I'm right and they're wrong, that's what we want to look at. That's what we really want to look at. Oh, yeah, when this button gets pressed, that really gets my goat. When this button gets pressed, there's a strong sense of self-righteousness or infatuation or greed or whatever it is, then the practice is to develop that capacity. This is changing. This is changing. This is causally conditioned. You keep putting into Dharma because what the habit of the mind wants to do is create a sense of self and just go for it and get reborn into it. So then you have to put a lot of effort into right view or right understanding. Even though you understand that, even though you've seen that and read that and considered that, at that moment of delusion, of delusion trying to overpower consciousness, one has to bring the Dhamma up, don't you? You have to kind of make it really conscious. This sense of self is an object of mind. This sense of resentment towards someone is an object of mind. It's a mood of the mind. This sense of infatuation or greed for slate floors is a mood of the mind. It's just arisen. It's causally conditioned. Then we can make really good choices. We can make skillful choices. So then, as we make skillful choices, like when we make skillful choices towards forgiveness, towards compassion, towards equanimity, see, none of those aren't energies which are imbued with sense of self. Like if you do metta bhavana for half an hour, may I be well, may you be well. We might use the conventional language of self and other, but when you've done that for half an hour, there isn't a strong sense of self and other. There's more a sense of the sense of self dissolving, isn't there? More just a kind of open connectedness to the way things are. Forgiveness, say, someone we had a dana here for someone who wanted to express forgiveness. So we had a lovely dana, and the person dedicated the dana to some friends who had died and asked for forgiveness and gave forgiveness. It's a lovely ceremony. And you could see for this person the sense of the whole history of that got very much rectified. So that was strong sense of having done something wrong or having, you know, could have done it better, I should have been different, I should have done it better, I should have done more. All that language, through a practice of forgiveness, a lot of that language fell away. And there's the peace of the heart. And And so, like, a practice of forgiveness doesn't enhance the sense of self and separation. It helps in the abandonment of those alienating energies, doesn't it? And if you look at, like, morality or the act of an act of generosity, it's never about alienation. You know, when someone comes here and offers a meal in good-hearted generosity, doesn't alienate, does it? You know, it connects, and there's comfort in being with others. When you look at the kind of deluded states of fear or resentment or whatever, they always alienate. They always this kind of separation from others in certain ways, and that's what we're trying to really get in touch with. That the sense of alienation, be it through fear or anger or judgment or cynicism or all the other ways, jealousy, whatever, that these are moods. And not to invest in them a sense of self. And as we don't invest a sense of self in them, we say, it's just causally conditioned. They might be very strong. I might have to endure them for, you know, a lot. They might come up a lot. But then as I just know, well, it's supposed to come up a lot. So like if someone's had a vicious divorce, you know, really, really, really nasty piece of, you know, kind of divorce emotions, all of that, and it's been emotionally very powerful, it's going to come up a lot. It has to come up a lot because it was so important. It was so emotionally powerful. And each time it comes up, there's a strong sense of self and other, or maybe self and self. I shouldn't have done that. I should have done it different. They should have a different. That's where you really have to practice, don't you? Oh, with this as condition that arises. And so there's a deeper and deeper understanding of memory. It's just memory. Memory works that way. Memory of an awful divorce case creates an awful feeling. A memory of someone being very generous and kind and good to us creates another kind of memory. Now, when we engage the memories of compassion, when we engage the memories of forgiveness, they are engaged with mindfulness, but quite often when we engage the memories of resentment or mistakes that we've made in the past, when we engage those, that engagement usually is just through heedlessness and habit. So if you think about metta bhavana, I sit down, I bring into consciousness the way I do it, I bring consciousness to my mom. Ajahn Kusala, you get a lot of good vibes from me. Everyone does. I bring that into my heart. I'm using memory. And I'm employing my connection to someone that I have already to trigger off a feeling in the heart of amity. And then let go of that. So that's the use of memory. I can use memory that way. The other, when I just remember, let's say I did something really, maybe I was cruel to someone 10 years ago, and I was really unkind to them, and that memory comes up 10 years later. 10 years later has the same power, maybe not the same power, but it's the same memory, has the same sense of, I shouldn't have done it like that, I should have been different. And then memory is no longer employed in a skillful way with wisdom. Memory just inhabits the mind in a negative way, and I become that. I become the person who feels self-disparagement. So memory is really very, very important to understand how it affects us and how it triggers things. And so we can make skillful use of connection that we have. We can make that strong. We can make that conscious. And we can notice the feelings of alienation which arise through, for whatever reasons, we can say, no, that's just a mood. It will change. It's not, you know, it's not who I really am. With this as condition, that arises. And as we know it as a condition, it has no energy to, we don't feed it. It's still unpleasant. You know, the memory of my mistakes in life, they're never pleasant. You know? Oh, great, I hurt someone. That was a really neat thing to do. It's never going to be that way. But that's just the way memory is. But we don't have to get lost in it. We don't have to get, and we can promote other kinds of memories, other kinds of feelings. One of the things that we've been reading, Ajahn Suchito, in the Wednesday meetings, one of the things he says he's been doing for a lifetime, or of a monastic lifetime, he tries to bring up into consciousness a memory of someone who has done something good for him. He says lots of memories, little things that someone has done, an act of kindness someone has done for him. And that's really skillful, isn't it? At the end of the day, you kind of just make conscious the goodness of other human beings. And what does that do to the heart? It cuts through alienation, doesn't it? The other is, oh God, this world is coming to an end, global warming. That kind of perception just burns you out. So as contemplatives, we have both the opportunity to view things through the Dharma, and we have the opportunity to make efforts from that understanding of conditionality, to make skillful choices to enhance the possibility of sustaining this aware mind, of this open heart, this non-alienated heart. We can do that. So it's not just passively watching anicca dukkha anatta, but it's engaging our way of viewing life with anicca dukkha anatta. That's an engaging kind of thing. And then the other, constantly making choices which are skillful, which are uplifting. And that, you can see, it's a training, isn't it? It's not something that just happens through belief. So you keep doing, you get better at all the time. Okay, I'll leave that for your reflection.